Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefert. Many people think of the classical record industry as a gentleman's game. It's considered to be pure, humble, a catalyst for great works, and isolated from the clashing egos and bling of mainstream pop. Well, Norman Lebrecht knows better. The British cultural critic has a new book called The Life and Death of Classical Music. It describes an industry that started out as a caretaker of a prestigious art form and is now slowly collapsing and devoting itself to scantily clad crossover acts and film soundtracks. Norman Lebrecht joins us here today. Norman, welcome back to Soundcheck.
John, good to be with you.
So we took a look at the top album list on Apple's iTunes, the top classical sellers this morning, and we find numbers 1 through 5, Joshua Bell, voice of the violin, the most relaxing classical music in the universe, followed by Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the LSO, the Appassionata record by Yo-Yo Ma, and Vivaldi's Four Seasons by the Israel Philharmonic. Now, of course, Andrea Bocelli then appears at numbers 6 and 9, but, you know, looking at that top five, does that represent a dying industry to you?
I'm afraid it does. I think what you find on Apple's iTunes immediately distorts the picture, because this is not high-quality music. iTunes delivers about one-tenth of the sound quality of a CD, and the people who are turning to iTunes and getting their music from iTunes are essentially people who don't know the real refinement of sound that was possible in a great recording. There are people who may be fans of the Israel Philharmonic for one reason or another, or who've heard of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, or who want something to relax by because they're going to the dentist, or whatever the reason. But this is not a public that is necessarily focused on classical music, that understands classical music, and that desires and wants classical music, which has been the public that has sustained the record industry for 100 years.
Well, one could argue that that's actually a good thing, that it's not preaching to the choir, but in fact getting new listeners, the people who do in fact have a dental appointment and want something to listen to on the way into the office.
Well, of course, it would be wonderful to believe that there is a great army of people out there who are flocking to classical music because it's available on iTunes. The figures say otherwise. I think if you looked at the numbers for those classical downloads on iTunes and you put them against any single pop act, alive or mostly dead, you would find them to be simply minuscule. And let me give you one statistic just to play this against. In 1955, we're talking just 50 years ago, when Gotthard Liebesen became president of Columbia Records, one in every four records bought and made was classical. Today, it's something like 2%.
Gotthard Liebesen, the man who famously used to sign his name God.
And with good reason. With good reason, because he was one of the great idealists of the record industry. Could you imagine anyone in the music industry today doing what Gotthard Liebesen did after he had his first massive hit with South Pacific, 6 million copies sold? He said, we have to put this back in the music. Not we have to produce this as dividend for the shareholders. We have to put this back in the music. So he went to Igor Stravinsky and he said, Igor, I want to record every note you've ever written and every note you're going to write under your supervision, so that for the first time in history, we will have a complete composer archive on record. And that's exactly what he did. That was the idealism that sustained the classical record industry in its best days.
All right, so that's 50 years ago. Today we have, as you suggest in the title of your book, The Life and Death of Classical Music, we have an industry in its, would you say, dying throes? Are you going to?
Yes, absolutely. No.
Paraphrase Dick Cheney here in...
let's not get into Iraq.
Okay. So who is to blame then? Why are we in this state?
Let me give you the parameters of this state. A decade ago, there were 6 major labels producing 700 new classical recordings a year. Today, there are only 2 of those major labels, major groups surviving, which is EMI Angel and Decca Deutsche Grammophon. Between them, they make fewer than 100 classical releases a year, and of those, more than half are crossover or music tracks or teenagers who've never been taught music but who look rather good in a skimpy frock. And so we have what was once a healthy stream has been reduced to a mere trickle and is... can be, as we have seen, snuffed out at a whim. An email from one of the groups in Hollywood that controls what remains of the classical record industry, and boom, another group is gone. There are still a lot of records being produced, but a lot of them are just vanity products. They have no economic viability. The mainstream flow of classical recordings is, I'm afraid, over. And this is a minor classical tragedy. This is a minor cultural tragedy, equivalent not to the drowning of Venice, but maybe to the loss of a couple of Palladian churches. And I mourn it because in its heyday, this was a pursuit that was driven by great belief in the integrity of music, in the value of artists, and in the admission of vast numbers of people in an audience to a kind of community of music where this could be shared, it could be passed from hand to hand.
My guest is Norman Lebrecht, the British cultural commentator, assistant editor of London's Evening Standard. He's the author of the book The Life and Death of Classical Music. I mean, several critics responding to your book have pointed out that classical music is basically just following pop music, you know, away from the big blockbusters, the rising tide that floats all boats, and going to a kind of indie DIY format where, yes, it is smaller labels, and some of them are indeed vanity projects. But it seems like for classical music, a style of music that even in its heyday couldn't compete with popular music, at least with a few exceptions, that actually is not an inappropriate way to go.
I think there is some truth in that, and actually it's a point that I make in the book. Again, the comparison won't stand up when you compare the sales figures of the indie classical and the indie pop. I mean, here we're talking of indie labels that sell 200 or 300 copies of a new release. That's not a viable proposition.
Right. So now your book, in addition to looking at all of the kind of facts and figures, actually looks back at the heyday, the golden era of classical recording, and also perhaps looks to the future with a list of 100 musical milestones and 20 recordings that probably fall under the category of what were they thinking. Let's start with a little bit of the former. Artur Schnabel's Beethoven piano sonatas are on your list of one of the 100 great classical recordings of all time. Let's hear a little bit, and then maybe we can talk about why, what the further importance of this is. Great Artur Schnabel and Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata. Norman Lebrecht, you write that Schnabel didn't want to make this recording until American audiences had a chance to hear him play these pieces live. How did he eventually, who talked him into making this recording that is on your list of the 100 best recordings ever made?
Schnabel was the last of the great soloists of his time to succumb to the lure of the record. He was talked into it by Fred Geisberg, who as a kid of 15 used to hang around Emil Berliner's garage in Washington, D.C., while Berliner was perfecting the flat disc as distinct from Edison's cylinder. So he is the first ever record producer, and finally in 1929, after the Wall Street crash, when Schnabel is wiped out, he persuades him to come into the record industry, and Schnabel sets strict conditions. He says, firstly, I don't want this to be sold on mainland Europe because I don't want my audiences there to confuse what I'm doing live with what I'm doing on record. Secondly, he says, it has to be sold in a subscription edition. I want to know who I'm playing for. I cannot play blind. So I want to have the names and addresses of everybody so that I can have them in my mind as I'm playing this music. And please, if possible, can I have a few people with me in the studio? I cannot make music without the presence of an audience. And you can hear this in the immediacy of the playing. It is phenomenal playing. It is also playing that is riddled with wrong notes, of which he was actually proud, as he would say in his lectures and in his writings. Music for Schnabel was ultimately the antithesis of recording. It was ephemeral. It was catching the moment rather than pinning the butterfly to the page.
Now, it's interesting that it was, as you say, Fred Gainsbourg who got Gainsbourg who got Schnabel into this. Because isn't he the guy who, back in the earliest years of the 20th century, was already predicting the death of the recording industry?
Fred Gainsbourg, the first record producer, the man who talked Caruso into making his first recording in a room in the hotel where one floor above Verdi had died the year before. Gainsbourg, as early as 1909, is writing to his brother Will saying, I don't think this thing is going to last. I think maybe we should go find ourselves some other career. The main players in recording, and particularly in classical recording, always understood the fragility of the medium, and none more so than Gainsbourg. There had to be a purpose, a reason for every record. It had to be right both in terms of repertoire and in terms of artist and in terms of an assessment of what the audience might be out there. If there wasn't, it was going to collapse. And twice it nearly collapsed. Now, sadly, it seems to have gone for good.
Well, is that simply a case of third time being the charm, or are you simply, Norman, the latest in a long line of Chicken Littles saying that the sky is falling?
Well, no, it is a process of prolonged decline. There was a period, I think, many of the milestones that I put in there, almost about a third of the milestones were made between 1948 and 1970, when some very, very strong and forceful personalities were dominating the scene. Not just artists, there were phenomenal artists, but people like Gotthard Lieberman, who we've talked about, people like John Culshaw at Decca, who was behind the making of The Ring, like Elsa Schiller at Deutsche Grammophon. And behind them, there were stories that if you wrote them as fiction, would just be, nobody would believe them. I mean, who could believe that Deutsche Grammophon was recreated by a Nazi war criminal in conjunction, in coalition, with a concentration camp victim? And between them, they created the most distinctive and indeed the most powerful classical record label there's ever been.
And which still survives to this day.
Which survives up to a point.
And which has, for the most part, shied away too much from the crossover phenomenon, still making their living off of that famous yellow colophon, the Deutsche Grammophon script. Now, you mentioned the Ring cycle. I assume you're talking about the Georg Schulte Ring cycle, which remains to this day the highest selling classical music recording. 18 million copies, is that the figure?
Yeah.
Ever released. So at 18 million copies, you are talking about something that has been outsold by maybe two or three pop records. It has outstripped virtually anything,
I think it's been outsold by about 130 pop records.
Really?
Yeah.
out of the hundreds of thousands of pop records that have been released.
But that is huge, and that is the... Here we are. It's coming up behind us. That is the product of vision and conviction and ability and an idea that this would not be a transparency of what you heard in the opera house, but of something completely new created in studio to provide an oral illusion for people sitting in their suburban homes, in their suburban living rooms, to reimagine the Ring from scratch.
And here's a little bit of that famous recording by Sir Georg Schulte. Just a moment from the Wagner Ring Cycle, actually from Goethe Dämmerung. Sir Georg Schulte's recording of Wagner's Ring Cycle on Decca Records was made over a period of years, Norman LeBrecht, between 1958 and 65. 18 million copies sold, the top-selling classical record of all time. Correct. Several times now you have referred to vision, which I assume you're referring to vision on the part of the people in the record companies who decided to produce these recordings, that the manpower, the financial investment was worth it to them. Is that what it comes down to with this?
Yes, it does. Yeah, it's vision and conviction. Here you have a case of a producer, a very young man at the time called John Culshaw, who'd come out of the Navy, gone into Decca, into the press department, was sent to Bayreuth in 1951, and understood from what he saw on the stage that if this was ever going to be a record in the new medium of stereo, it would have to be created in studio and not be done with opera house forces. It would have to be cast for record, and he would have to convince everybody within his company that this was worthwhile doing. Fortunately, he found a conductor with whom he had an almost symbiotic understanding in Schulte, and the financial brains behind Decca at that time was a man called Maurice Rosengarten, who was a strictly Orthodox Jew who lived in Zurich and didn't answer the phone from Friday afternoon till sundown on Saturday, knew nothing at all about music, never pretended to know anything at all about music, but was prepared to be swayed by the power of an argument. And between them, Schulte and Culshaw gave him the argument, and he finally gave the green light to Rheingold. They had to persuade him each time for each of the four sections. But when it was,
well,
finally,
once you've done that first one, isn't it just in for a dime, in for a dollar at that point?
Well,
you know.
Well, yes, but once it was finally complete, they started in 1958. They finished in 1965, and that set did more than anything to convince the middle classes of the Western world to transfer from mono to stereo, because here they were getting a sound picture that was not available in any other form, in any other media.
Right. We're speaking with Norman LeBrecht. His book is The Life and Death of Classical Music, and features his list of the 100 best and 20 worst recordings ever made. And of course, the Schulte Ring Cycle is on that list of 100. But as we look at some of the 20 worst, are these generally more current? Is this more a symptom of the fatigue of the industry at the end of its useful life?
There have always been bad records. And what I was looking for here was not records that are bad because somebody's not been playing terribly well or somebody should never been allowed into a studio. But what I'm looking for here are the stinkers that were made with the very best of intentions, where everybody in the company thought this is going to be tremendous and was so wrong-headed from the start. Who in their right mind would go to Yasha Heifetz, the leading violinist of his time, and say, Yasha, you are so good, you shouldn't just be playing one part in the Bach Concerto for two violins, you should be playing both of those violins. And the result is something that can truly hardly be imagined.
I have trouble imagining who went to the Berlin Philharmonic and said, you know what would be great? If you took this platinum orchestra and played with scorpions. This is what resulted. So, Norman, Moment of Glory by the Berlin Philharmonic and the heavy metal band The Scorpions. I'm guessing this was not a moment of glory for either band.
Well,
in your book.
The Berlin Philharmonic is an orchestra in which every player is the musical equivalent of a brain surgeon and a full professor to boot. And to use those skills for the equivalent of chopping wood with the Scorpions, who are an extremely good heavy metal band in their own right, is an act of sheer absurdity. It arose from the collapse of the recording work that the Berlin Philharmonic were doing. There was no longer any classical recording for them. So in order to compensate the players and to allow them to buy their second Mercedes and maintain their homes in the country, the record company EMI thought, well, why don't we put them together with a heavy metal band and see what results? And oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. I don't think anybody on either side wants to admit that they made that record.
Well, now, crossover has been a particular bone of contention for you over these past years. Is it a symptom or a cause of the impending doom that faces the classical recording industry?
It's a symptom. It's a symptom of decline. Basically, what happened was that in the 1980s, as a result of compact disc, there was a huge boom in people buying classical recordings. First, because compact disc, if you remember, was launched as an elite product, and 10% of the early releases were classical. And then because people who listen to classical music generally want the very highest quality sound, and so they went about renewing their whole collection. So towards the latter part of the 1980s, classical recording was once again back at 11 or 12% of the record market when it had been down to 4%. And then it tailed off. People had renewed their collections. They didn't need to buy anymore. They weren't interested in the artists that a really safety-first record industry was putting in front of them. This was a record industry that was signing conductors to do 85 recordings. Somebody like Giuseppe Sinopoli, a very nice man and a very good conductor, but you need 85 CDs from this man? So there were some terrible executive decisions being made, and they tried to counterbalance those decisions with something that they thought might appeal to a young audience, such as a Eurasian fiddler in a see-through wet swimsuit, or other gimmicks of that nature. And of course, they bombed one after another. They didn't necessarily bomb immediately. The first record would succeed. A follow-up would then be negotiated at a vast fee, and the follow-ups would bomb.
So Three Tenors being an example of a crossover phenomenon that you know, made a huge splash, and by the end had become sort of a caricature
of itself. That's right. That's right.
All right, Norman, a last question. Last year, actually, just a few months ago, we saw the death of Tower Records.
Yeah.
But now we see classical downloads rising 18%. Does that give you any hope for a new generation of classical music listeners?
Yes, it does. It does. But it's a regeneration that will come out of a vacuum. My regret is that the classical record industry couldn't have been sustained in its vitality until the new medium was ready to come on stream, which it plainly isn't. The quality of downloads is uniformly poor. You cannot get a high-quality download yet of classical music. If the production of classical recording had been sustained for another 4 or 5 years, then there would have been a smooth transition. At the moment, the best we can hope for is a kind of Bailey Bridge, a rickety thing that conjoins the two. And in a certain sense, it is aesthetically satisfying that music which came out of the ether became concrete for a century, became something that we could hold and have and cherish unto ourselves, and is now returning to the ether. So there is a symmetry to that, and that's not a bad thing altogether.
Norman Lebrecht's book is called The Life and Death of Classical Music, and he and I will be continuing our discussion at the Strand Bookstore this evening.
I look forward to it.
It's also going to include composer-critic Greg Sandow and conductor Alan Pearson, so that'll be this evening at the Strand at 7 o'clock. Norman, I will see you then. Thank you for being with us this afternoon on Soundcheck.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure.
This is Soundcheck.